Mining companies have to do something to restore the land after they're done mining it. But it isn't always returned to its original natural state, especially if it was a forest. A new program is changing that.
We're going to grow some really nice trees in this area.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, reclaiming mine land for wildlife. And a lot of conservation work relies on the dedication of volunteers, like a project to keep an eye on bees and other pollinators. But the citizen scientists get something out of it, too.
They enjoy just zooming in on a meter-square plot. It's kind of therapeutic, but also you get to know the pollinators in that way.
Plus, some say there are too many farmers markets. But for many growers, it's a reliable source of income.
As far as sort of keeping the farm going, supporting ourselves, that's farmers markets.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. In Pennsylvania, previous efforts to restore former coal mine sites have left behind large swaths of stunted land, places where trees and wildlife just aren't thriving. Now conservationists are using a new strategy to regrow forests and to bring back some native species. Andy Cubis has the story.
Deep in the Moshannon State Forest in Elk County, Pennsylvania, there's a sloped patch of land surrounded by an otherwise healthy forest. It looks as if a tornado has torn through here. The earth has been churned up with tangled roots and jumbled rocks. John Hecker is a forester for the state.
And as you can see, it's a very bare site presently. I mean, there's no trees here.
In the late 1800s, this area was deep mined. Later, it was strip mined. When the coal companies left in the mid-1990s, the land was abandoned. Then about 12 years ago, the site was reclaimed. That's the term for the federal government's directive to coal companies to make mine land useful again. Often that's meant planting trees, but they didn't take in this area.
The technology back then was to just recontour the land, but the bulldozers, as they ran over it, they compacted the soil. Well, the trees don't do very well in compacted soil.
Hecker manages this tract of land. He says now this and hundreds of acres of formerly mined land in Pennsylvania are getting an ecological do-over, reclamation 2.0, you could call it. That's why the ground is ripped apart. A jumbo-sized bulldozer with a 3-foot blade came through here earlier in the year and crisscrossed the ground with furrows.
It also loosens the soil where that furrow is, and it allows the tree roots to grow down into that loose soil where it's moist, and those trees will really grow well.
This aggressive form of bulldozing is a relatively new technique. It's only been used for the last 10 years or so. It's called the forestry reclamation approach. Scott Eggerud is a forester and regulator with the Office of Surface Mine Reclamation Enforcement, part of the Interior Department.
This is not what they taught us in school. What they taught us in school is you pack it in, you put aggressive ground covers under to stabilize the site.
And that's exactly what happened here. The non-native grasses they planted took over. They did really well on that compacted soil. But the problem was that the grass got so thick that rainwater couldn't seep into the ground. It might as well have been concrete. Instead, it would run off, polluting the streams below. This new plan will change that.
Instead of water washing off the sites, it now infiltrates, and it's more natural, the way it was supposed to be, the way it was before mining. We're going to grow some really nice trees in this area.
A crew of professional tree planters was brought in earlier in the week to get the bulk of the lot planted. And now it's up to volunteers to do the rest.
Take a seedling out of there, put your hand around the roots, stick it way down on the bottom hole, then pull it up so the root collar, right where the root starts, just a little
About 20 volunteers with big orange buckets gather around Eggerud. He shows them how to put the tree in the hole.
When you empty that bucket, we have a prize for you. Guess what it is?
Another bucket!
Another bucket!
Yes. I love other buckets!
They're planting over 2,000 trees today. White pine, quaking aspen, red oaks, and black locusts. They're all native tree species. The Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources grew and donated them.
I think we'll plant another pine.
The volunteers fan out, navigating the jagged terrain while carrying buckets of tree saplings. 12-year-old Trey Slavonic is quiet because he's really focused on what he's doing. He's here with his dad and little brother.
This is important because it helps, cover up all the mistakes people have done within the mining and taking the coal off from the top layers. It makes it then look more natural, have it better, and more habitat for the animals.
About half of this 45-acre site will be left as grassland. The wild elk in the region will like that. But today's tree planting will help another animal, the golden-winged warbler. This migratory songbird comes to Pennsylvania each year to breed. populations have declined by 2/3 since the 1960s. Laura Bray is the program coordinator for the Pennsylvania Environmental Council, or PEC. She's overseeing this reforestation effort across the state. Bray says the hope is that the warblers will be attracted to this spot as the trees start to grow.
It's nice to have these edges where you have mature forest, and then you'll have some grassland, you'll have some wildlife shrubs. It's a good opportunity for us to make this site productive again.
It'll be about 50 years before there's mature forest here again. Scott Eggerud, the forester, hopes the volunteers will come back to see how the trees they've planted are doing. Though he says it's not just about growing trees.
The trees are an indicator of the quality of that site. If we're growing nice trees, that tells us that we have a very healthy ecosystem. You can't replace everything that was here. You replace the major components, and it just speeds up the healing process.
Now that the planting is done on this site, next up is the Gallitzin State Forest in Cambria County. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
Well, we're getting there.
Science relies on data, lots of it, and the time and dedication to collect and analyze the information. That's where volunteers, citizen scientists, come in. We just heard about volunteer conservationists planting trees. Well, in Allegheny County, volunteers are needed to watch bees.
In addition to the bees, there are also beetles, butterflies, even ants that are on flowers and whatnot. So in the project, we're counting any insect that lands or goes onto a flower.
The project is Project Bee Watch. Carrie Rouse is a graduate student at Point Park University, where it all started last year.
Globally, there's been a decline in pollinators. You hear about colony collapse disorder with honeybees. In the Midwest, they're seeing a decline in bumblebees. But really, there hasn't been a study specific to Allegheny County, so there's no baseline data. So we don't know how pollinators are doing in this area.
So Rouse is here at the Environmental Center in Pittsburgh's Frick Park to train pollinator watchers. The 10 people here in the classroom today will each receive a manual to help them identify bees, wasps, and moths, and the plants that they're drawn to.
So now we're on this last page. We're asking people to randomly select an area for their plots.
Each volunteer will use a 3x3-foot plot, a couple of bamboo sticks tied together with twine. That's the tool used to mark off the section of wildflowers where the data will be collected.
They enjoy just zooming in on a meter square plot. It's kind of therapeutic, but also you get to know the pollinators in that way.
Rouse says pollinators are facing threats like loss of habitat, pesticides, and invasive species. Wildflowers depend on pollinators for reproduction, and so do gardens.
Some pollinators are generalists, so they'll go and pollinate a variety of flowers, but some are also specialists. For example, bumblebees can pollinate your tomato plants, and they have a very specific way of pollinating where they kind of shake the flower and shake the pollen off. So really, they support the food system, they support healthy ecosystems, and that diversity is really what we need as well, because there are just so many niches that each one fills.
The volunteers grab a plot and head outside to the sunny meadow behind the center. It's one of the designated areas for the study. It's mid-afternoon and just a little breezy. Perfect weather for pollinators.
This is catchweed or bed straw. It gets its name because it's really sticky, so it'll stick to your clothes and things. But it does get some small blooms.
Rouse shows the volunteers how to estimate how much catchweed or clover is covering the ground within the plot. That goes onto the data sheet that's inside their manual. It only takes 10 minutes to complete a survey, and volunteers can do it as much or as little as they want through October. They'll send the information they collect to Matthew Updike, a professor of environmental science at Point Park. He started the program and oversees it.
I think there's been so much focus on honeybees that we've kind of neglected the native bees.
Allegheny Land Trust, a local partner, is already using what they've learned to help plan habitat for pollinators on their properties.
So we definitely want to inform the public as well as natural science organizations and hopefully government agencies. Hopefully they'll catch on and say, hey, look at this data. This is the status of, say, bumblebees. Maybe we should do something to bring their numbers back up in terms of planting certain types of wildflowers.
Susan Feynman is here to volunteer. She was a teacher for 30 years.
I'm trying to do a pollinator garden at my house, and I'm interested in the 4,000 kinds of bees we have in this country that I never knew about.
Was there something that stuck out today that you learned that you didn't know before?
Just that there's so many kinds of bees in this little manual that they gave us, and that they're not even all bees. There's some flies that look like bees, so I feel a little bit fooled, I guess, but...
Caroline Littlejohn is a dentistry student at the University of Pittsburgh.
It's just nice learning about it and seeing that, like, we can come out here and do something to try to help.
You can learn more about Project Beewatch and pollinators at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Farmers markets are great. You can buy food directly from growers, taste produce that's fresh and in season. And markets have become a lot more convenient for shoppers, popping up in shopping centers and parking lots. But that's got some farmers wondering if bountiful markets are really better for their bottom lines.
There's almost a farmer's market, sometimes two, every day of the week. So you're then spreading that customer base amongst more market days.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, have we reached peak farmer's market? Stay tuned. At the time of this recording, there are 23 Democrats running for president. That's practically a baseball team. Each is trying to distinguish him or herself in this crowded field. So which of them has a plan to deal with the very real and very pressing problems of climate change? We've hit a new high in the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, 415 parts per million. The UN says we have about a decade to drastically cut carbon emissions in order to prevent catastrophic climate change. President Trump dismisses warnings like these. So climate change is an opportunity for his Democratic opponent in the 2020 election. Most of the candidates will probably have some kind of climate plan, but what will the plan look like? For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier talked with Emily Holden, an environmental reporter for The Guardian who's following the 2020 race.
So let's start with a piece that you wrote recently. You surveyed the race and found only two candidates had anything approaching a detailed climate plan so far. It's Jay Inslee, which may be no surprise. He is sort of the climate candidate, but also maybe a bit of a surprise, Beto O'Rourke.
This is our final chance. The scientists are absolutely unanimous on this, that we have no more than 12 years to take incredibly bold action on this crisis.
What can you tell me about what these two folks are saying about climate change?
Sure. So to be sure, a lot of the Democrats who are running for president are talking about climate change frequently. They see it as a serious threat. But these are the two that have actually rolled out something official saying this is our plan for how we're going to deal with this crisis. Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, says that his plan is based on a lot of things that he has done in his own state.
We need a nominee of the Democratic Party who will stand up to Donald Trump's idiocy saying that wind turbines cause cancer when we know they cause jobs.
He essentially wants the U.S. to be carbon neutral by 2045. And he lays out ways to get there. So he starts with the electricity and transportation sectors and buildings building up to 2045. And then more recently, he put out a second part of his plan that is focused on basically transforming U.S. infrastructure and trying to create a lot of good paying jobs at the same time.
So today, I'm announcing my plan for the evergreen economy, a plan to put 8 million Americans to work. And not just any job, but good-paying jobs across the United States of America.
And I am proud. And Beto O'Rourke, he has a little bit of a similar plan, far fewer details, but he would try to get carbon neutrality by 2050, and he would spend $5 trillion on it. Inslee, on the other hand, says that he would have the U.S. investing $9 trillion.
And just to be clear, neither of these plans are saying we're going to use $9 or $5 trillion of the federal expenditures. There's like some tax incentives at work and things like that.
Yes. And part of it would be using federal dollars to essentially leverage private capital.
We're going to go to the other candidates in a little bit, but I'm wondering what has been the reaction to these two plans, if there's been any.
I think Inslee's has been pretty heralded. I did see that there was one contributor to the UN's IPCC report, kind of the body of all of the climate change knowledge that the world scientists agree on. One of those authors was endorsing Inslee's plan. And I think that a lot of people are saying that seeing these details from Inslee should be making other candidates come out and talk very specifically about what they would do, or at least what they would pursue.
Climate change is his one issue.
I'm Jay Inslee, and I'm running for president because I'm the only candidate who will make defeating climate change our nation's number one priority. We can do this. Join our movement. This is our moment.
What might the effect of, you know, his ideas or these sort of more detailed ideas that come out earlier in the race, how would that affect the race overall?
Well, I think you certainly have reporters paying a lot of attention right now to climate plans and asking all of the candidates, when are you going to release something? Or, you know, have you decided if you're going to take fossil fuel money donations or not? But at the same time, we have the Green New Deal, this proposal from progressives that many of the candidates have said that they would endorse the strategy behind. And I think that's given them kind of a little bit of cover to say, look, I'm backing this really ambitious idea. We'll get the details out soon. And maybe has slowed that process down a little bit.
Besides O'Rourke and Inslee, what have some of the other candidates said about climate change? Any policies that stuck out to you?
Well, I think we can safely say they all back, you know, more research and more funding into technology. We've seen pretty big plans in the past from some of these candidates. So Bernie Sanders, for example, he introduced a bill a couple of years ago that would have cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050 in the U.S., which is definitely substantial. He recently has been talking more about the Green New Deal, and he hasn't gotten as much into more of the specifics, although I think we can expect to see something more of a plan coming from him soon. Elizabeth Warren has had this idea that has caught on pretty well to ban new drilling or mining on federal lands, which, you know, the carbon emissions we see from those activities, it's pretty significant in the U.S. It's about a quarter. But banning the new drilling or new mining would have a smaller effect. So it's one of those things that when added together with other plans and other things she has suggested, it could make a big impact. Most of the other things that you have seen have been some of the more traditional sort of carbon cutting efforts that we have been talking about for many years, like the changes that you can make with energy efficiency and in buildings and kind of across all of these sectors.
Right. And let's talk a little bit about the Green New Deal. Maybe you could just explain what that is.
I like to say it's a vision. In legal terms, it's a resolution, not a bill, not the typical kind of legislation that we talk about. And so it's been drafted and co-sponsored by many people in Congress, Democratic progressives, and it really lays out all of the things that they would like to see happen at the same time that the U.S. is fighting climate change. So it's this idea that you can make these wholesale changes to the way that we live, to the way our economy operates, essentially, you know, ratcheting down and then eliminating a lot of fossil fuel, if not all fossil fuel use. And you can do that without overburdening the people who are already burdened, like the poor and communities of color who are already feeling the effects of pollution and could otherwise also feel the effects of the rising costs of things as you implement these changes.
What are candidates saying about the Green New Deal? It's been sort of like attacked from the right as, you know, sort of a pie in the sky, a liberal wish list. Are candidates generally kind of defending it?
Many of them pretty rapidly endorsed the general idea, and it really did give Republicans an opportunity to come back to Democrats and say, you know, we dare you to say this is what you really want to do. You've seen them force lawmakers into votes on it because they know that this would be something difficult to vote on. But at the same time, I think a lot of the leading Democrats here running for president, they do think it's the kind of scale that's needed for this problem and that it's something that their voters would like. Now, I think that could change a little bit once we're at the general election.
And this kind of brings us to somebody who's sort of looming large in this race, and that's Joe Biden. And a few days ago, an advisor of his was quoted as saying that he would seek a middle ground on climate change. That led to a lot of criticism of Joe Biden that, you know, there is no middle ground on climate change, on the sort of physics and chemistry of the atmosphere.
If the same politicians who refused to act then are going to try to come back today and say we need a middle of the road approach to save our lives, that is too much for me.
I've never been in the middle road on the environment. I made a speech on the floor back in 1987 and talking about why there's an existential threat to humanity if we don't move. So this idea that I haven't done anything, take a look at the record. That's what I'd say.
Do we know what a Joe Biden candidacy represents with respect to climate change?
Well, I think, and the piece you're talking about was in Reuters, and it's an advisor to him, and I think his campaign has pushed back a little bit on that idea and said they'll be putting out more details soon. But what that piece kind of envisioned as a middle ground is continuing to use natural gas to replace coal, focusing, you know, really on the electricity sector, pursuing a lot of the things that the U.S. has already tried to do and not so successfully, including the kinds of regulations they were pursuing before the Trump administration.
It sounds a lot like kind of some of the things we heard from President Obama in sort of, you know, 2010, like, you know, all of the above, natural gas will help us get off of coal and that'll be good for climate change. Is he sort of just revisiting that stance from Obama?
I mean, from this one story, it does sort of sound a little bit like that. And I know that a lot of advocates were really hoping to see something different from Biden. They're hoping that he could reposition on this and go with something bigger and bolder. But I can't say that I would be surprised if he put out a plan and it didn't have, you know, an end date for carbon neutrality.
Right. And it, just explain, why would that be important?
So the science right now, and most recently, one of the UN IPCC reports said that we had about 12 years to rapidly put in place and start implementing a plan to basically eliminate the emissions that we're continuing to put out. Right now, we know more than ever that there's this huge urgency, and that urgency is going to require setting a specific timeline for when the U.S. is going to reach a specific goal. That's according to scientists. And they say this, you know, not just for the U.S., but the rest of the world as well. And these are the sorts of things that are attempted at through international negotiations, but those also have not at all reached the point that scientists say is necessary.
So by not including an end date, you're sort of pushing this sort of deadline back indefinitely and basically past the point of no return.
Well, and most of the experts that I talk to say, if you're looking for a candidate who is serious about climate change, who is really going to try to fix it, you know, to have a substantial contribution to the world fixing the problem, they need to have an end date and they need to show their work on how they're going to get there. They need to show you that, you know, they would be looking at different sectors and what sorts of things they would consider in those sectors. And that's everything from electricity, transportation, buildings, to industry like cement making, which is a lot harder to decarbonize, to agriculture and land use, things that, you know, we have many of the answers to, but will be pretty big hurdles to just change the way that we're living and doing business in the world.
Emily Holden is an environment reporter for The Guardian, and she spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth. The other half of their conversation is at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Over the past couple of decades, farmers markets have been multiplying in Pennsylvania, from parking lots to town squares. Will the trend continue, or have we reached the saturation point? Well, WPSU's Christine Allen visited a farmer's market in central Pennsylvania, looking for kale, apples, and answers.
It's opening day of Milheim's outdoor farmer's market, held under a pavilion on the grounds of the American Legion.
What do you have for sale today?
Beef, pork, and chickens. Next week, we'll add guineas to that. Later in the season, we'll add turkey, ducks, geese, and some other poultry.
Bill Callahan of Mifflinburg is the owner of a farm with the tongue-in-cheek name Cowahen. He's been farming for 38 years.
And I've been doing the markets, farmers markets, for approximately 20 of those years.
So you've really seen the whole farmers market thing explode over the last couple decades.
I have. It has grown tremendously. In particular, the variety of stuff that we have now is greatly more plentiful than what we had 20 years ago.
There's more produce and more markets. Pennsylvania is listed by the Farmers Market Coalition as one of the top 10 states in the country with the most farmers markets. The state has more than 300, and many markets these days are stretching their seasons. Some even move indoors for the winter. Here at the Milheim Market, most of the farmers say they go to two or three markets per week. Callahan says he sells 75 to 80% of what he produces at the markets.
So we depend on the people who come to markets for the bulk of our business.
For us, farmers markets are certainly an important piece, but it's not the only piece.
Megan Coopy is co-owner of Way Fruit Farm in Port Matilda, which has been in her family for six generations. Sitting in the Way Fruit Farm Cafe, she says farmers markets have reached a point of diminishing returns.
There's almost a farmers market, sometimes two, every day of the week in Center County. So you're then spreading that customer base amongst more market days.
There's a feeling that there is too many markets.
Brian Moyer is an educational program associate with Penn State Extension out of Lehigh County. He follows farmers market trends.
I don't personally think it's a matter of the number of markets. It might be more the location of markets. Some might be too close to others.
Moyer says that most people who shop at farmers markets live within a 5-mile radius of the market location, and multiple markets too close together create competition.
The other problem we may have is that we've reached the population that was willing to shop that way.
Moyer points out that not everyone can shop during limited farmers market hours. And another factor, he says, is a trend toward more local produce in grocery stores.
They are also looking to purchase food more locally, or at least giving the perception that what they carry is more local.
The local food trend could be double-edged. Moyer points out that local produce in grocery stores could compete with farmers markets, but stores and restaurants that want to purchase more local food, he says,
create opportunities for farmers to enter that wholesale market as well.
Moyer says these factors have contributed to a modest downturn in farmers market profits. He notes that farmers market sales around the country started to fall about 3 years ago.
From that point forward, it's just kind of been flat.
Flat or not, some farmers still get a large part of their income from farmers markets, like Michael Arthur of Tamarack Farm, who's at the Milheim Market selling meat, wool items, and vegetables.
We have mostly greens, that's what we specialize in, but we do all the rest, tomatoes, onions, cucumbers in season, and so forth, squash.
How important are farmers markets to your overall business?
Oh, definitely. Most important. That's what keeps us going. We do some sheep and wool festivals, but as far as sort of keeping the farm going, supporting ourselves, that's farmers markets.
At the Milheim Farmers Market, I'm Christine Allen, WPSU.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schuman Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth.